Welcome to Talking Sense, the sensibility podcast, presented by Ungagged, where two North American women attempt the impossible.
Talking sense about Scottish politics.
So as mentioned before, we want to thank the Ungagged family for taking us on board. It's been a few months that we've been back to podcasting, and it's thanks to their help. While we're here, I want to just give a quick plug for the other podcasts that Ungagged puts out, Hollyrood Ungagged with Deborah, David, and Brian, where they break down current events happening in Scottish politics, and World Beat with George Collins, where he interviews people from around the world about lefty politics. And every once in a while, we can look for a special interview by some of the other Ungagged team. Anything to add to that, Erin?
Not really.
special shout out to our editor, Neil, from Ungagged.
Yeah, without whom none of this would be possible.
And real quick, before we get started on this month's episode, I want to draw your attention to the AIM conference taking place on Sunday, the 29th of May. It'll be all day. Doors open at 8 a.m. in Aberdeen. Please check out AIM's Twitter page at AIM Aberdeen for ticket sales and details.
Well, speaking of Aberdeen, today's episode has an interview with Fatima Joji. At the time that we interviewed her, she was running for council in, was it Aberdeenshire, not Aberdeen, right?
Aberdeenshire, yeah.
Yeah. She's running for council in Aberdeenshire. We're delighted to say that she has since won her seat. The discussion is about being a woman in politics, the pressures faced by BAME women specifically, and about how to get more women not just running but winning their seats. So it is great that she has won. This is in the face of the overall council results showing that only 35% of council seats presently after the election are held by women. So some good progress made, but a lot of work ahead of us.
Well, that seems like a perfect segue, Erin. So with that, we'll continue on with our interview with now councillor Fatima Joji. So I'm your co-host, Kat.
I'm your co-host, Erin.
And this month with us, we have our guest co-host, Fatima Joji. So please introduce yourself.
Hi, and thank you so much for having me on. I'm so excited. I'm just hot off the campaign trail this evening. I had the day off work today, which is really great. So I went for a bit of early morning rowing, and then I was just out campaigning, went for a bit of shopping with my sister, and then more campaigning. So that was really great.
The council candidate for what ward is it?
West Tilland District in Aberdeenshire.
And then for our listeners who don't know us all already, Fatima is in the SNP. She's one of the SNP candidates, and she's also part of Aberdeen Independence Movement.
So I'm a co-chair with Jack Gillies. So my former role when I first joined was blog editor and got elected into co-leading, which is fantastic.
So hot off the campaign trail, how has it been going?
It has been great. I think there's a bit of voter fatigue going about, and I don't blame anyone because many people are worried. They've got other things to worry about that's occupying their minds. And a lot of the time, the last thing they want to do is stand at the door and chat to someone when they're probably trying to rush up and pick their kids from school. They're worried about how they're going to pay their bills next month. And that also comes to a discussion about the main themes that are coming out of the campaign when I'm out and about. And it's a lot to do with the cost of living. It's a lot to do with the crisis we're seeing and our national response to it. And also how different our response is in comparison to England in terms of immigration. So that's another thing that sets Scotland apart, which is why I'm proud to be a Scot, but not proud to be, I'm ashamed to be British, but proud to be Scottish because of these different approaches to societal problems. And another thing that is also really interesting to hear is that a lot of people have praise for the First Minister and how she has handled the COVID pandemic, contrary to popular belief. And I think the popular belief you would presume is popular because of how noisy Twitter is. The First Minister on the ground, there's a lot of praise for her. And it's not just from within the SNP ranks, it's coming from apolitical people and it's coming cross-party. I won't probably say as far as Tories because they would always look for something to take a dig at her, no matter what she's doing for the problems that they've caused. But other than that, yeah, so that's what the campaign's been like for me, really.
And so, like, Fatima, you're kind of my hero because you did the impossible. You unseated an incumbent councillor, which was really difficult to do. And what one of my political beefs always is, but it's been very recent, is about getting more women of color.
Yeah, I mean, if you'd like to elaborate, actually, like, we might as well talk about it now, about like the issues faced by women and BAME women as candidates and through the vetting process. As you're saying, you're getting sort of these emails trying to suggest that you're not from the ward you literally grew up in.
Yeah. So they're not as much as what I got during Holyrood. And I got the latest one I got was 2 days ago. I actually shared it with some candidates. And everyone keeps saying they've never had emails like that. But the second I ignored, the third one I was like, okay, that's three now. These people are either coordinating or they're just separate people who have seen a BAME candidate and they want to ask, can I prove that I've achieved what I've achieved? So basically, yep, the receipts are there. I even wanted to ask publicly on Twitter, but I was like, I won't go into that. They were like, can you prove? No, they were like, yeah, tell me what qualification. You said that you got this and this and this and that. Can you state which companies you worked for? Can you say their names? Yeah, state which companies you worked for, how long you worked for each, and send me proof. And I was like, what proof do they want? Is it my degree certificate or is it my employment contracts? Because I don't know what else. So I asked a few other candidates. They said they didn't go get those kind of questions. And I was like, if they did, what would they send? They were like, don't even bother answering, because I did feel a bit insulted by it as well. I was like, it's either absolutely they don't believe me or they think I'm too young to actually achieve that stuff. And I think it just goes down to the point that you tend to overdo it. You tend to overprepare women, we tend to overprepare, we tend to overdo it. BAME people especially, like, I don't know to this day why I kept pushing myself to get this degree, that degree, that job, this job. Just trying to accumulate all these skills just to say, so just so I can have the same chance as the average white bloke, because that's the reality. You know, women have to work twice as hard already. And then think about the more intersectionalities you have, the harder it is for you. So it is a really sad reality that we're sort of used to. So we tend to prepare as if it's just a natural course of order. We don't realize the toll it's taken on us sometimes. And you just sort of build that strength in you. It means that you can take on a lot, to be honest. But it's very visible, those standards. Those were the emails. And I was like, I am not going to, if you don't believe me, then you don't believe me. I find the way you're asking, I don't think it's an innocent way you're asking those questions.
Right. It's not a legitimate concern.
And also that's covered in vetting. Like,
yeah, I know. I mean, it's there. Like, if you just Google my name and some news articles, you'll find out the newspaper I worked for, because the articles are there, but they wanted proof. And the way they were asking is like they felt I was lying, that I couldn't possibly have achieved those things. So I felt a bit down. But then also at the end of the day, I've been receiving so many nice emails from constituents. So it's nothing compared to the brilliant feedback I'm getting back. So it just makes me feel even more determined to serve people in my ward, because I'm seeing so many lovely people out on the streets and through email. And that just drowns out the two or three bad eggs who just remind you of how hard it is sometimes.
Yeah. Sorry, I do want to, Erin is having a coughing fit right now, so she's muted right now, but we'll just keep on, okay?
Okay.
I do want to circle back to what you said about being young. Now, this is something that, like, I find it very odd because, so I'm not, Erin and I aren't standing for anything, right? I'm one of the organizers of my branch, so we have, like, 7 wards, partially. So I have, like, 6 or 8 candidates, basically. Yeah. And you know, there's a few older candidates. We have a lot of like people in their 20s and 30s. Like, yeah. I don't think that that's that young to be in your 20s and go to be council. Like, I don't understand it. And everybody keeps going, you're so young. You're so young, to people who are almost 30, who are grown adults. So like, what is that? And like, just, you know, your thoughts. I'm sure you've had quite enough of it. So if you want to have a rant, go for it.
The thing is, I'm 30. So I really don't understand what they're trying to say here, first of all. And if I'm still too young, what is the cutoff age? And then is that representative of your demographics? Which is not, if you're going to expect someone to be wait until they're like 40, 45. I don't think you're too young to run. And I'm actually in agreement that you should be able to learn as you should be able to run for at least council level politics from the age of 16, because, you know, councils are all about delivering services and support, and people from right from birth experience the impact, or whether that's at good action or at the inaction of the service delivery. And that says a lot about the sort of experience we need. We need 16-year-olds who maybe benefit from, let's say, maybe the care experience people, for example. You have really young care experience people. And if it's constantly the adults in the room making decisions for them, that's how we are obviously going to put forward policies that only do half the job for them, because their views, their direct lived experiences are not listened to. I've seen 14-year-olds with more life experience than a comfortable, privileged 66-year-old, for example. A 14-year-old that's been homeless, that's experienced poverty, that's watched a parent maybe die from a drug overdose. I mean, that's a lot of experience for someone. And then taking that knowledge, that life, it is life experience. If you've seen all that, it's absolutely life experience, and you're just 14. And maybe 14 might be too young, but at 16, you can take what you've learned and actually improve services, because you would have witnessed, you would have probably said, if my parent got this support, that support, I firmly believe they would have been here. And those are the voices that are not listened to. So I really don't understand this go get life experience. I mean, what is the minimum cutoff age? And those people who say it, I'm pretty sure all of them have different ideas of how old or how young you should be before you run. Those people who always say, oh, you're too young. I'm sure I'll ask one person who'll say, oh, you have to be at least 40. And then another person, you have to be at least 50. Where does the conversation stop? So I'm just like, okay, you can say that. But to be honest, we're all here. We're working hard. We know we want to improve stuff, and we're not listening to this patronizing way of beating people down.
So, I think what you touched on just there about councils being all about delivering services is really, really important. And like, and as you say, a huge range of ages is absolutely necessary for that. Someone who's just left school will have a very different perspective on education services in their area than someone who hasn't been in school in 50 years. Someone who is a young mother who's just had a baby is going to have a different perspective on nursery provision than again, someone who's in their 60s or 70s and hasn't had to deal with that in a long time. Absolutely. And it's so important that like this range of people is represented, which sort of like brings me to a question that I had about being a candidate and sort of knowing intimately what sort of the local issues in your ward and your council are. How does that sort of make you feel about the way these campaigns can sometimes become about a sort of broad referendum on parties in charge of the Scottish government or at Westminster, the way we've seen some of the leafleting going out, being about issues that are not local issues or not even Scottish Parliament issues, but sometimes Westminster issues, instead of actually being focused on the service provision that's so essential from councils?
Oh, so do you want my comment on how people campaign? Maybe they focus more on wider issues instead of local issues. Is that just what my critique on that? I'm not sure if I understand what you're asking.
Could I direct this at Erin? Because this is Erin's turn to have a rant, because there are certain parties that are promising things that they couldn't possibly deliver. And in fact, aren't Labour. The authority of a council, correct?
Yeah, I don't know why I'm being so vague. Scottish Labour is promising to reduce your energy bills.
I'm happy to comment. I'm absolutely happy to comment on that as well.
Yeah.
Because if you look at what Labour is promising, they're promising stuff that's actually reserved to Westminster or to the Scottish Parliament that has absolutely nothing to do with councillors. So they're basically lying to the electorate. They've set themselves out to break promises already, even before we've got to the polls. That's one thing. The sad reality is that a lot of people don't know that what they're actually promising is something that councillors can't deliver. That's another sad thing, because I don't think people, not everyone's clued up on what councils can and can't do. So I think Labour has taken advantage of that. I think that's a very dishonest way to campaign, and it just shows the kind of party that Labour is. Are they really there to serve people, or are they there to just serve their own interests, which is just to get people in so that they can just push their own agenda, not actually listen to the people? If you really wanted to listen to the people, you would actually talk about stuff that you can actually do and promise to work hard on it and actually do so. They clearly have nothing to offer at local level. They're either so bad that they know they can never achieve it, or they're just weak themselves, or they have no information themselves about what council actually does. So it just shows them up in a really bad way, all in all, to be honest.
Yeah. I mean, I'm obviously in Glasgow, where, you know, Labour governed the city for like half a century and have only been out of power for like one term. And they're already like, one, they were just, I've only gotten those like national level leaflets that are the promises that are things that are devolved, like reserved to Westminster. Oh, it's even worse. Two, one of their Glasgow leaflets that I haven't gotten, but other people have, has photos of Edinburgh tenements.
Please tell me they're not saying they're supporting local businesses on that leaflet and then printing.
Well, I haven't
the
received
businesses
it.
That are not local.
But I saw the photos online. I was like, oh my god. But like the third thing is like they are like this thing where you say like they have no ideas. They have no ideas. They're like just the only times they make arguments about local issues, it's about ones that they messed up in their half century in power. They've only been out of it for a few years. I think this is like a broader problem though, with like people not having been like our system not doing a very good job of educating people about like what the different levels of government are responsible for, because we see Scottish Labour and the Tories do the same thing at Holyrood elections. They'll start attacking SNP on things that are reserved and like, why haven't you done this? Well, it's reserved because, I don't know, Scottish Labour, you argued against having it devolved, so we can't really do anything about it. But because it's quite difficult to understand, I think for people whose political education sort of predates devolution.
I mean, let's be fair and honest with each other. We are way too like turned on to everything.
Oh, no, exactly. We are not like, normal or representative.
Right. To a level that's probably disturbing to some people. Like my mother, I think, worries about me.
You know, it's kind of interesting because they basically shoot themselves in the foot when they're pro-union, because they put all this blame on the SNP, and I'm pretty sure they know that this is reserved with Westminster. So, and they want us to remain shackled to Westminster. So the fact that they can't even see the arguments for independence through this as well, knowing that the SNP response has always been different, knowing that we will do things differently. If you just look at SNP policies in response to everything that's been going on, it's completely different. We'd have a different ideology. We would have approached it differently. And we care about those who are deliberately silenced or the preferably unheard. We care about these people, which the Tories don't, because they're so out of touch and they're the people with all the power, and we didn't vote for them as well. Scotland did not vote for them. So, you know, it just reinforces the argument for independence.
Well, here's the thing about the SNP that I think is great. It's such a broad church that everybody can have something that they like identify with and something they hate in their own party. Right? But like, at least you know you're not in a party where everybody agrees, because guess what? Nobody's in a party where they agree with anyone. I don't care if the party's 30 people. Like,
that's what conferences are for. That's what Paul is for, us to set the agenda as well. If we don't agree with something, we can use conference to change that.
I cannot wait to have a real conference again.
I hope it's not in Aberdeen, because I would like to actually get out of Aberdeen for a bit because of COVID. I love you. Aberdeen. I'm not even from Aberdeen anyway, so I'm fine saying that. I'm from Aberdeen Clare. They are actually two separate, yeah, if you look at our demographics.
But how far away are you from Aberdeen?
So I am a half hour drive. So we basically start the Shire. If you notice, if you drive into West Hill, it says, welcome to Aberdeenshire. We're basically the start of Aberdeenshire.
All right. So let's go back to talking about local elections and having our little rants, because this is fun. being a woman that even is in a volunteer position that's any way visible in politics. So Erin's a co-convener of OFI. I'm an SAP socialist in AIM. You have been, I mean, what have your roles been, Fatima? You're like everywhere in a good way. We have all caught our fair amount of abuse, right? Fatima and I first got to know each other because she was giving me a heads up and like, hey, I hope you're okay. And also, by the way, watch out, because I saw this person like on your feed and they made my life hell kind of thing. So like, thank you for one thing. And also, do you just want to, you can vent or you can talk about it? Because I know it's just really hard to like take on all the abuse that comes with volunteering to do a not great paying job.
Yeah, I'll balance out probably a combination of venting and also highlighting why we need to persist as well. Because I am also on the board of 50-50 Parliament. So it's a cross-party campaign group that was set up to encourage more women into politics. We help them to get selected and elected. And we have a list of people who have actually come through us and are now sitting in Westminster or who are councillors. So that's really great. The headquarters is London, so maybe that's why we don't have a lot of success stories in Scotland, because there's also Women 50-50 who operate solely in Scotland. So I think they cater more to people in Scotland, but we are UK-wide, and so which is why I would encourage people to reach out to us, because we do touch every parliament, including Wales and Northern Ireland. So we hold a lot of events. So that was a very long wee. So we host a lot of events. So we host a lot of events, and a lot of them, one of my favorite ones, I think one of the most productive and constructive ones, is Connect and Reflect. So that's held fortnightly, and we use that to vent, and we also use that to chat about ways going forward. It's more of a support group where women come together, diverse women come together, share our stories and help each other get through it. Offer everything said there is confidential, which is fantastic. And, you know, it's a very beautiful space for you to just let everything out and then go away feeling empowered that you've got people beside you every step of the way. So the thing with politics, there are double standards. So basically it's about men in politics. They can be average, they can be terrible, but a woman, we have got to be all the good things all the time at once, kind of thing.
Yes.
So that's us, whereas men, they can get away with being mediocre. So there's that double standard in politics, and because of that double standard, women are scrutinized more. If you're looking at the events of the past year, you know, the law breaking, the pandemic, any decision that's made that's impacted citizens of this island. We're a cute tiny wee island. For those of you who don't know, we're very tiny, so I don't understand why we can be so awful sometimes. So the thing is, a lot of the people who are being dragged through the mud, the people who are being forced to resign, are the women, and the men seem untouchable. It seems like the women are always the fall people. And that's what politics is like. Women, when things go wrong, it seems to be the women's fault. I mean, with Boris and Kari, it got to the point in the media narratives that they started blaming Kari for all Boris's bad decisions. I mean, in one way, you're making an argument that a woman is that powerful that she can tell a man what to do. But then they won't admit that, because people are like, women are weaker, women don't have opinions. So how can you say that and then at the same time say that women are what's wrong with the world? As far as I'm aware, all the bad things we're seeing the wars that predate World War I were all started by men. All, if I look at the many of the countries that are led by women, we are doing great. I feel that life expectancy, I feel our outlook is progressive, we are happier. And, you know, I think a lot of it has got to do with the fact that women feel they need to work harder and not, we can't have a bad day in politics. That's what it feels like as well, because the moment we do, you are scrutinized to the death. It's as if you've done something horrific when you haven't. That's how it's played out in the media. Everything's scrutinized, from our dressing to the way we talk to the way we look. And, you know, that can be really hard to deal with. You can go through all those things in a news cycle in less than 24 hours. You experience triple what a man experiences. And, you know, it does take an emotional toll on you as well, because of societal expectations of a woman as well. And these, so it's always good to have a support network, because the sad reality is that we've been trying to change this for so long, but attitudinal change takes time. So the reason I push for more women in politics, because I think with their strength in numbers, the more women that we get in politics, the more we can prove that negative stereotypical mindset of women not being capable wrong, first of all. And we can also support each other. So I think it's another, an important thing is women supporting women, because the only people who benefit, well, the only system that benefits from women not supporting women is the patriarchy. So I think we teach ourselves all those things in our connect and reflect sessions. We teach ourselves that it's okay to let it all out, to let those emotions flow. We teach ourselves that it's okay to feel you need help, to feel you have the support system. Then we teach ourselves that it's very important for women to support women, and that there's strength in numbers. So whilst you need to be prepared for what you're getting into, there's that bright light at the end of the tunnel you need to look for, and that's through other women. I can go on and on, like I'm giving some kind of sermon at a church, but I would have thrown a bit of music in, to be honest.
You were preaching to the choir. Yeah.
But no, that's the thing. It's difficult, but we need more women, and there's absolutely going to be more room for women. That's not going to end. So it's either people get on board with it, that women are here to stay in politics, or they step aside and let us fix things, because that's what we normally do. And we're going to show you that we can do a better job.
Amazing. I completely agree on like basically all of that. What steps do you think need to be taken to encourage more women into politics? Since like completely agreed, we need more women to run and run in winnable seats and get elected.
You've mentioned a key one. Women being put up in winnable seats, first of all. We have very capable women, but people just prefer to, some parties prefer to put women in just women forward as paper candidates. They prefer like the mediocre, less qualified man to be the one who's elected, because they feel that men are the vote winner. So it just goes to show that the parties set the tone as well. So I think the first one you mentioned is putting women in winnable seats. And then the second thing is parties have a massive role to play. You have no idea how much parties can make or break this system of encouraging women into politics, because we have to go through our parties to get selected, first of all. We need our parties' support to get elected. And if you look at all the stories of women who have withdrawn from elections, a lot of it has to do with the internal structures of the party that have put them off. So that goes to show that the parties have the most important role. And that's why we work with parties. We work with them very hard to educate themselves on the biases they have towards women, on the fake support. To be honest, some parties are just good at talking about support for women. They're not. But when it comes to putting forward action, you have a lot. You can see a lot of flaws there and a lot of inaction.
Am I allowed to be like, cough, cough, Lib Dems, cough, cough?
Well, yeah, no, absolutely. Lib Dems, 100%. Listen to yourself, yeah. Guys. Look in the mirror. And I do not want to hear a certain politician pretend that he supports women when he's part of the problem. So,
exactly.
Yeah. So that's one thing. And then another thing is within party structures is who we have at the top influencing these decisions about who we select. And we need to put women there who support women. Not just put, we need to elect. And let me just say that there's so many capable women, so I don't even want to hear the argument that women aren't capable, that we don't have capable women. They are. And I'm willing to bet, not even just because of our population size, but for every one capable man you find, you will find two capable women. I'm pretty sure. We just don't make an effort.
We have to look harder for the women.
Yeah, or it's not even that. We actively put barriers in the way, to be honest. We put barriers in the way. It's not even that. It's not a matter of not finding. We put barriers in the way. That's why these women are never to be found. So that's the third thing, removing those barriers. And that goes from all aspects of society. You know, women don't see themselves in certain areas, in certain roles. Part of removing those barriers is encouraging women, capable women, into certain positions. I keep saying capable because I'm wary of these trolls who, if they listen to this podcast, they will just assume that we're just sticking any old woman. It's not true. Women are capable. And, you know, women have a lot to offer. So, and I feel that many men who attack women on Twitter, their own definition of what's capable is prejudiced and is flawed. So
I have to say, how many idiotic men have held office and hold office to this day? How many men that are just dangerous to themselves and others, and we just deal with it, right? You know what? Maybe that's the key. We need to get all the qualified and maybe even some mediocre women elected, and maybe then we'll have some equality. But we just have the brightest and best.
No, absolutely. Yeah, so that. And then I think another thing that's really important to encourage more women is mentorship. You know, that really goes a long way in helping women grow as well. Everyone needs guidance, and women especially, we are prone to beating ourselves up because of the way society is structured. So if you're mentored by another woman who's there, who's in that position that you want to find yourselves in one day, that goes a long way in helping you. And you know, your mentor doesn't even have to be a woman. My mentor is a man. Mm-hmm. Shout out to Christian Allard. So he's the one who, he's really the one who encouraged me into politics. So it's important you get mentors. And that comes on to my final point of men supporting women. He for she, he for they, he for them. Like everyone, just men supporting diversity in every way. Because men are the glass ceiling. I think what we also need to do is think boldly. A mad man not think twice about trying to unseat a woman. Why on earth do we have to give them that courtesy of not unseating them, especially if you feel you can do a better job than them? And this has no reflection on the reasons I stood at all, but just generally, if you feel you can do a better job, if you want to be in that position, just go for it. You do not have to be like, oh no, like, no, they're there, let me just, because I assure you, men don't think like that.
Mm-hmm.
That's true. Well, most men don't think like that, so let me not overgeneralize as well before I'm accused of being a man hater again. So
again, all of us have been accused of that.
Yeah.
The reason I got called a man hater the last time is because I said that we should have more women in politics, and maybe some men need to step aside to allow that to happen. So, oh, you're taking away opportunities for men. Okay.
Like it's got, you know, I have a son. I have to try and prepare him for a world that's not going to be his oyster necessarily, which is fine. I think that's a good thing. But like, there's a lot of people that are like, I was told that these things would just be given to me. Like, what's happening? I kind of feel sorry for some of these guys, but they're really making all of our lives horrible a lot of the time.
So no, absolutely, women. I think just go for it. It's good to get support network as well, because, you know, obviously there'll be greater scrutiny when a woman obviously takes those bold steps. So also make sure, I keep going back to support network because that is crucial. That is really important, because the moment you are in it by yourself, the moment you feel alone, it's going to be very difficult. And what you need is to be able to go all the way. So get your cheerleaders behind you.
I really like that you've highlighted like these really practical steps that can be taken to encourage more women into politics, like setting up mentorship and, you know, actively supporting women candidates and changing party structures to make sure that women get nominated to winnable seats. Because I see a lot of talk about like how to get more women into politics that sort of circles around just like, oh, well, we need to change the culture to be like less horrible to women before women will. It's like, no, we need more women in politics to change the culture. We can't change the culture without more women in politics.
That's exactly it. Because if you're going to wait for attitudinal change, you're going to be waiting for like 10 centuries again. Because it takes time, as I said, and you need to actually be in there. You need women to be in there to create that change as well.
So is there anything that you'd like to plug other than yourself for council and the AIM conference at the end of May that we already covered? Is there anything else? Like, are you reading anything? Are you into anything else? Like, you probably have no time, but.
Oh, no. So a lot of my friends know this, but I'm obsessed with learning languages. So right now I'm learning Korean, Mandarin, Japanese, and French. So I'm learning those languages. I've gone the furthest in Mandarin, followed by Japanese, followed by Korean, and followed by French, because Mandarin I'm actually learning at university. So,
cool.
Yeah, and I actually got to practice my Mandarin at this Chinese restaurant in West Hill called Yad, and she said my pronunciation was okay, so that was good. Yeah, so I'm learning those languages. I love listening to Korean pop music. Mm-hmm. I just think they have a lovely, like, upbeat vibe, and I love that sort of music. And on Netflix, I would highly recommend people watch Anatomy of a Scandal. I mean, it's mainly for politics geeks, but it touches a lot of contemporary scandals in Westminster, and that's on Netflix just now, Anatomy of a Scandal. If you prefer reading, there it's based on the book. Yeah, I was like, if you're a woman in politics, please know that there's always support there. I mean, you might struggle to find it in the right place, and that might be the daunting thing, but it is always there. And as much as it's easy to say, hang in there, it's easier said than done, but truly it's worthwhile, because you will get to that place where you will get that support. And if you're looking for it, please reach out to me, honestly, if you're struggling. Just please reach out to me, because we seriously, seriously need to change the political landscape. We seriously need to consider that. And, you know, society does not improve if half the voices are missing, and that's the women. So please, that's my parting thing. Please, if you're remotely thinking about it, please go for it, because we need you. You have something to offer. Don't let anyone tell you that you don't. So that's my parting word.